Welcome back to the Injury Pros, where we break down law like a South Philly cheesesteak. Layered, messy, and worth every bite. I'm Steve DeBonis from Credisco & Sale, and today we're digging into the world of workers' compensation. What it is, how it's different from traditional injury laws, and where they overlap. Joining me is Mr. Personality, Tom Wigg, managing partner at McMenamin & Wigg, LLC. Tom is born and raised in Delco, calls Philly home, and brings a decade of gritty courtroom-tested experience in the workers' comp sphere. Welcome, Tom.
Glad to be here.
So happy to have you here. So let's just jump right into this and nip this in the butt. If there is a particular entity defense side, who are you cringing, throwing your phone, makes you angry, your whole day's ruined?
The city of Philadelphia comes to mind, honestly.
And why is that?
They do some of the claims that I have to handle with them are the most aggravating, just jaw-dropping, ridiculous fact patterns where they just don't care what the rules are. I had a case where a woman tripped, fell, broke a bone on the property. They deny this claim because she might have smoked pot like 6 months before, which is not a defense of the claim anyway. And they dragged it out 9 months before they paid her. And that's pretty par for the course for the city.
Now, with the city of Philadelphia, just generally speaking, is it something that you find they pay out quick? And you said that they dragged their feet a little bit. But as a shelf life of looking at workers' comp versus personal injury law, sitting in my shoes doing that in catastrophic injuries, sometimes we're at the gauntlet for at least a year, 2 years, and sometimes even three or four in litigation. How does that compare to kind of what you're seeing in the workers' comp realm?
Sure. So we don't have the same discovery process that an injury claim would have, right? You file your complaint, you're going to go through a lengthy discovery process, you're taking depositions, and then you eventually get that trial date, you know, 2-3 years down the road. In workers' comp, as soon as you file that lawsuit, you have a hearing within 30 days. The shelf life of the average case that walks through my office is a little bit less than 12 months open and shut.
People must love that in your world, because in ours, it's kind of like the well is dry, time is turning, things are changing, the seasons come and go, and we're still churning at the bit. So that's interesting. So kind of understanding, somebody doesn't wake up one day and say, hey, I want to do workers' comp. It's a very specific niche with very specific laws and understanding. How did you find your way into workers' comp law, and was there a moment that locked it in for you?
Yeah, nepotism, actually. So I'll tell you the story. So my now law partner is my uncle, Roger McMenamin, and when I was in law school, I did interning work for them. I wrote legal briefs, I did research memos, things like that. And after law school, he got me an interview at the place he was working, a firm called Shore Levin. People may remember the ads for the Bulldog Lawyers if they're old enough. And I walked into then the managing partner's Jay Shore's office, and he said, well, nepotism got you this interview, but you got 1 year to make me money. And the rest is history. I've been doing workers' comp ever since.
So tell me a little bit about your company, your firm, and kind of what is instilled in the culture there. I know personally at Credisco & Sale, you walk in, there's a mission statement. Our mission statement is filled with specific niches and beliefs that are instilled in not only our work, but that we pass on to our clients and giving back to the community. Tell me a little bit about McKinnon and Wing and basically what they stand for.
Sure. I mean, we are not fancy enough to have a mission statement. As I was commenting when I walked in, this is a very fancy office. But what I will tell you is, most of the employees that work with us were with us when we were at Shore Levin, and the average length of an employment for someone in our office is over 13 years. So awesome. We keep people around, and one of the reasons we do that is we try to hire people who have been touched by the system that we're working in. So a lot of the people that work for us either have been through the system or have a family member or a close friend has had some experience with the workers' comp system. And so they can really relate to the clients. First and foremost is really service.
Is there a specific service area just for our listeners and just common knowledge? Is it predominantly Philadelphia? Are you guys in the entire Commonwealth? Are there boundaries to where you guys will touch and serve?
So the boundaries is the state of Pennsylvania. We've got four offices. We cover the entire state. We'll go out to Erie. I'll go. We have an office up in Bradford County, right up by the New York border. We have four offices. I think six or seven lawyers now, and we cover the entire state.
So now shifting gears a little bit from a sense of where the roads of workers' compensation and personal injury law combine. A lot of people lump those two together. Do you see that with your clientele? And ultimately, what's the difference and why does it really even matter in our world?
So I do see it lumped together a lot. And the biggest problem with that is you end up with these dabblers in the workers' comp system. You touched on it before that it's a very, very niche system. We have our own administrative law judges. We have our own rules. In fact, we don't follow the Pennsylvania Rules of Evidence. We don't follow the Pennsylvania Rules of Civil Procedure. We have a special rule book called the Special Rules of Administrative Practice and Procedure before workers' compensation judges. And so people try to dabble in it because they think it's like injury and they can really screw up a claim, particularly when there's a third-party claim. That's where personal injury comes in. So you say, you know, you're delivering a package for Amazon. You get rear-ended. Well, you're going to have a workers' comp claim that's going to pay for your lost wages, your medical expenses, things like that. You may also have a negligence claim for the person for that striking vehicle. And that's where you would come in. We don't do any of the liability work. But if you are not careful in handling that workers' comp claim, you can do a lot of damage to that third party case.
And it's funny, I think you've done the term that I'm going to start using, dabbler. People who dabble in and out. We see that sometimes on the PI side and many times, and I'm sure you experience it too. You have to come in on that 13th hour and you have to inherit the case and you kind of have to undo the bad, undo not to be explicit, the F-ups and the screw-ups. And sometimes you get in quick enough where you're able to do that, but sometimes it's too little too late. The rubber stamp has been implemented, the ink has dried, and it's problematic. But looking a little bit at where those worlds combine, many times, like you mentioned, the negligence case where it's that motor vehicle rear end, the person's in the course and scope of their employment, just by a tortfeasor, third party rear ends them, and there's problematic. We deal with that on our end of the PI side, and we don't want to touch the workers' comp case. Just like you said, we don't want to dabble. We don't dabble in that world. We do catastrophic injuries. We do the motor vehicle slip and fall, amongst other things as well. It just makes for a cleaner case. And with that, though, you also have liens to worry about. The workers' comp is not a, I will say from a PI side, not a forgivable environment to live in. They are ruthless. They are cutthroat. And when we have a settlement in place and I have to go back, I many times am on hands and knees asking for a reduction because the algorithm, the calculation is pretty specific. It's this is the settlement. This is the gross. This is the lien. And you go back and you're basically begging and pleading saying, hey, maybe a third, third, a third. Have you experienced that or run into that on your end of things where the PI attorney's calling you and saying, this lien's ridiculous. Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, 100%. So one of the things we do, a big source of our business, I guess I should back up a little bit, is other attorneys. So we've kind of developed this boutique practice where the vast majority of the work we do is from personal injury lawyers. And one of the reasons we've been so successful is we will handle all of that. So when you have that third party claim, we already know what the lien is. We're going to take care of negotiating that lien before you even get that first settlement offer, so that your client's not freaking out, but you can still plead those as, you know, you get your damages and all of that. So you're getting all the value for your client, but at the same time, they're not having sticker shock when they want six figures back on that comp claim.
And speaking from experience, we've exchanged referrals back and forth, and just like Credisco and Sale, your entity has been flawless with responsiveness. I mean, there's sometimes when we send referrals out that it's crickets, it's dormant. And I hope that you could say the same thing about us, but we're responsive. Even if it's, hey, I send you a text and you send me a text and intake enters, it's responsiveness because very similar in the first time that we met and the dinner we had, purgatory is a scary place, especially with clients who aren't getting immediate feedback. And that clientele experience, that white glove that we talk so much about here that you share, I think that's why we get along so well because we're on the same wavelength of, these are people. These are people who are hurt. And this case might not make or break the firm's future, but it's going to make or break this person's life for the immediate future, especially if they can't go back to work, especially if they're that hurt and they can't provide for their family. It takes 2 seconds to respond to an email. It takes 2 seconds to send them a text and let them know a status. And I see that implemented through your entity, especially, is there certain things that you do within the firm to be responsive? Are there certain rules and regulations that, hey, you have to get back to a client in 30 days. If they call, you better get back. Our golden rule here is we're touching base at least one time every 30 days to get the updates on medical records. Because many things, at least in my world of the PI side, don't happen quickly. Whereas you said the shelf life for yours is 12 months. So things are moving pretty quick. You need to get those medical records. You need to get the information. Is there a golden rule that you're informing your staff or you're training your staff about if a client calls, they need to get an answer today or something of that?
Yeah, so there's a couple things. One is we've kind of changed the way we handle workers' comp claims from sort of that standard assembly line, what you see on the billboards, right? We don't have sort of teams where you have 30 different people who are touching a file. You come into my office, you have one attorney, you have one paralegal. That's your team. And every attorney in my office is required in the very first written communication a client gets. So as soon as they sign on that contingent fee agreement, they get a welcome letter from us. They're required to include their cell phone number in that letter. So every client has direct access to the person who can answer every one of their questions. And it's not like they're, you know, burner phone that turns off at 5 p.m. on a Friday. This is their actual cell phone. I'm routinely texting clients, you know, Sundays, late at night, early morning. Workers' comp is a little bit different than personal injury in that emergencies can happen at pretty much any time. You know, somebody goes back to light duty and they're having a problem and they're working third shift. They're doing like 3 to 11 and they have a problem. They're saying, oh, you need to go move these, you know, concrete blocks or whatever it is. They need to be able to reach their lawyer to say, what do I do? What do I say? Because they risk re-injury. They might be worried about getting fired. They need an answer right away. And so we've instilled on the staff that yes, they need to get back to clients, but more so the attorneys, that you need to just be available. It's just not optional.
You said something light work, and I wanted to segue into that. We'll talk about Segwick later, but nonetheless, light work and that kind of terminology is something unique to workers' comp. I see it on my end where there was an individual who's injured and they're fully disabled. Social Security disability is another beast in and of itself, and we've probably talked for hours on that. But the light duty that you talk about, do you see retaliation being something that is often reoccurring more times than not, where doctor, plaintiff doctor, signs off and says, hey, they need to be light duty for 30 days. And managers and private entities are pushing them to kind of be like, you can just lift one, or you can just lift 10 to 15, even though the FCE says that you're supposed to do light work less than 10 pounds. So FCE, if you want to touch base on what that is real quick, for our listeners who don't know what that is, but not saying, do you see a lot of people trying to push them out of that comfort zone and bend the rules a little bit and kind of blur the lines to benefit that company that they're working for?
Yeah, we see it all the time. And it doesn't really matter the size of the company. You see it from large multinational corporations, and you see it from little mom and pop businesses. I wouldn't call it necessarily retaliation, but they're just trying to get the job done, and they find an injured worker is really just an inconvenience to them. And one of the tools we have, you've touched on an FCE or a functional capacity evaluation, where someone comes in and tries to objectively measure what this person can safely do. And that can be a tool that we can use to say to this employer, to a judge, if it gets that far, hey, this person really needs to be restricted, because otherwise they're just going to end up more injured, and it's going to end up costing that employer, that insurance company, a whole heck of a lot more money.
Now, when you say the judge comes in, is that like the police enforcement in essence? So if there's a discrepancy, obviously in the PI side, we're going into court, we're having pleadings, we're having depositions. I always talk about a triangle. In the PI side, that triangle is liability, injury, and then coverage. That being said, you want to check all those boxes, because if it's your fault on the PI side, 9 times out of 10, you're not getting recovery. What analogy kind of would you give to that triangle to better understand how the workers' compensation, there's a lot of clients that I talk to, and we'll get into it a little bit more, is like, well, I was injured on the job, I want to sue my employer, and that gross negligence, and we'll talk a little bit about that too, but how would you kind of, someone who's not really familiar, or those dabblers per se, to understand workers' comp in its simplest form, that triangle analogy that I gave?
Sure. So, I mean, you can't sue your employer for a work injury in Pennsylvania. You can go in the workers' comp system, you get your wages paid, you'll get your medical bills paid if you have like an amputation, get specific loss. There are disfigurement for to the face, head, and the neck. And then we also have death benefits, obviously. But other than that, you're stuck in the workers' comp system. You get only the benefits that they provide. There's no pain and suffering, anything like that. I guess the triangle is if you get hurt in the course and scope of your employment, workers' comp has to cover you. It's not optional in Pennsylvania. Every employer has to have it. If they don't have it, there's a special fund that pays uninsured claims and then goes after that uninsured employer. The Commonwealth is very insistent that every single employee has to be covered. So as long as you're an employee, you're not an independent contractor operating a separate business, you're covered.
Is there a limitation in regards to the insurance that each employee at a business has to have? So for example, the analogy, and I'm going to keep pulling back to the PI side, to drive in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, you only need $15,000 of bodily injury. It's an awful amount. And I'll get off my soapbox because I can just talk for hours on that. New Jersey's 25, not like it's any better. But does the workers' comp field kind of have, in essence, a similarity where each claim has a maximum payout of X, each employee from zero to 30 employees, and if it's more, they have to be covered up to a certain amount?
So the workers' comp policies themselves, most of them do have policy limits, or they'll have deductibles or some kind of coinsurance like you'd see. I mean, go to the doctor and you have to pay your portion. We have no idea as injured workers' counsel. The Workers' Compensation Act has no cap on the total amount a claim can potentially cost. And there are some claims, not a lot of them, but there are some claims that go into the tens of millions of dollars. If somebody, you know, falls off the roof of a building, is going to need round-the-clock care for a lifetime. Doesn't matter if they only have a $1 million policy. That employer's on the hook for all of that care.
And is that a lump sum out, lump sum payout? Is that a, is that basically over time being paid out? Is it periodically? Typically in the workers' comp field, my understanding is that it's a one lump payout. Everything's said and done. And you have to make sure that you're putting forth your best injuries. And when I say putting best, your best injuries, what I mean by that is more so that you're presenting the boardables, as we would call it in our world, of that future care, the household chores, the lack of gainful employment. Is that something that you have economists on standby for, vocationalists, or is that just, is there kind of a chart that you can kind of go back?
The vast majority of injuries, the person is ultimately going to go back to gainful employment. Now, they might not be a bricklayer anymore, or they might not be climbing up scaffolding anymore, but they're going to be employable. And workers' comp doesn't care that you can go, you have to go do something else. Workers' comp cares, are you employable and how much money can you make doing that? And for the vast majority of people, they're going to be able to go back to work in, you know, 6 months, a year, 2 years, and they're going to be making about the same amount of money they were making before, or they may make more money. And that does tend to put a cap on the value of a lot of these claims. There's not really a set chart, but there are significant claims where you're talking about somebody who's never going to be able to go back into the workforce. You will bring in an economist to price out not only the wages, but you're also going to have to price out the future medical exposure, particularly if you're going to have somebody who's going to be on, in the Social Security disability system. You must consider Medicare's interest in that claim. They're going to have to do what's called a Medicare set-aside. They're the set-aside money that in some instances Medicare will review and approve or make suggestions for changes and say, hey, you need to make sure that Medicare doesn't foot the bill for any of this. This is workers' comp's problem. So there are a number of moving parts in these claims.
Now, is the lump sum out that the clients receive, is that tax-free? Is that something they have to pay taxes on? How does that have any implications in the realm of, all right, I got this money. Is it free and clear, or are people going to come knock?
So the same, it's in Section 62 of the Internal Revenue Code. It defines what gross income is. And it's the same exception that personal injury has, that all workers' comp benefits are tax-free. And that's true if you get a lump sum settlement. It's true if you're getting weekly indemnity checks. But yeah, that's not subject to tax.
You talked a little bit about, and obviously the intro, born and raised in the Philly area, call Philly home. We both know collectively, just for rooting for the sports teams against them, the pain and suffering throughout the years. Philly is just overall a very blue-collar city with blue-collar pride. How do you see that being ultimately, that toughness being reflected in the clients and the cases that you have?
Sure. I mean, So particularly when you have clients that are working in the city of Philadelphia and they've worked at a particular job, you know, if you're a cop or a firefighter and you've been at that job for 20 years and you get injured, a lot of times all of those people that you've worked with that whole entire time are turning their back on you, or you can't trust them. And so it's great to represent these people. There is a lot of spirit, particularly with our first responders and such. But ultimately, we have to be that resource, that rock for them, because as gritty as the city of Philadelphia and its residents are, it's a very difficult system to get through.
Now, you mentioned that they have a lot of these familiar coworkers and colleagues turning their back on them. But what would be one sentence or a few words that you would give to that person who has suffered a work injury and now is feeling alone, isolated, and just lost?
Get yourself a lawyer. Because unfortunately, the first advice I have to give them is trust no one.
Okay.
And so your resource is that workers' comp. It's why it's so important to have that communication with the attorney directly. You know, don't just pick up the phone and call somebody on a billboard and talk to their call center. And then, you know, maybe you talk to the lawyer 6 months from now. You need to have that open dialogue. You have to be comfortable with that person because they're going to be sort of your guardian angel, your guide for the next at least 9 to 12 months.
And I know there's and you'll probably be able to talk more about procedural and administration things within the workers' comp REM. But specifically, I know, and this is me admitting fully, we don't dabble here. My information is based on conversations with you and personal knowledge and just kind of educating myself. I know, generally speaking, if you worked on the job, you obviously have to report that. There's something reporting rules that are affiliated with that. But in a situation where you aren't sure if you're hurt or if you're kind of, like you said, toughened out a little bit, what are you supposed to do if sometimes I wake up with a headache, it goes away? Sometimes that headache lasts for a few days. What is something that these individuals who feel that they might have got hurt on the job should be doing, or at least noting or speaking?
So you should report every injury, no matter how minor. I don't care if it's a paper cut, report it. Because the easiest way to get a claim denied is delayed reporting. Now, you have 21 days to report your injury, and then you'll get retroactive benefits back to the date of injury. You have 120 days to report that injury, you know, between that 21 and 120 days, where the claim will be paid from then going forward. But if you don't report that injury in that first 120 days, it doesn't matter how serious it is, you get nothing.
So when you say report, if an individual is knocked unconscious on scene, amputee, those are things obviously not going through their head at that given time. Is there a notice requirement, or is there any exception whatsoever within that time frame if someone just forgets?
Yeah, forgets is not going to be an exception, but certainly in the instance of, you know, somebody's knocked unconscious and the employer takes them to the emergency room, they're going to assume that the employer had notice of that injury. If they try to litigate that issue, they're probably going to be paying my attorney's fee.
And now, in regards to the reporting, so once a reporting is done, my understanding is that your claim would either be accepted or denied.
Yeah, the employer has 21 days to accept or deny liability for an injury from when they receive notice. It's the nice thing about workers' comp is in the beginning of the claim, the only thing the injured worker is legally obligated to do is report that injury. They don't have to do anything else. Then everything shifts to the employer. They need to investigate that injury. They need to provide a list of approved physicians, panel lists that the injured worker can go treat with. Otherwise, they don't get to control the medical care in that first 90 days. They have to accept or deny liability. There's a number of things an employer needs to do, turn on the wage loss checks if the person's out of work. But the injured worker really just needs to report that injury and get checked out by a doctor.
Now you said, I cringe a little bit because I heard you say they have to report it and then they control the medical treatment. Now in my world, the best thing that we kind of see is a person who starts with a provider, their own physician, neurosurgeon, orthopedic, whoever it may be, whatever the specialty is, and they continue treatment with them. And then what happens usually during litigation is they do something called an IME, which is an independent medical examination. And these are people that the defense attorneys or defense insurance companies handpick and basically say the complete opposite, even though it's clear as day, of what our plaintiff diagnosed and prognoses aren't. Is that the same thing in their world because they're controlling it, they're sending it to these people?
In some respects, it's worse. So what happens is with a, particularly with large insurers, the insurance company is really picking who's on those approved provider lists. And they like to use these McDonald's of doctors, sort of these assembly line outfits of get them in, get barely document anything, and then ship them back to work. And I can't tell you how many cases I've had where somebody goes to one of these occupational medicine clinics, is told, maybe you have a sprain or a contusion. And then they pick up the phone, call me. And I'm like, your symptoms don't seem right. You should probably go to the emergency room. They go to the emergency room and have surgery. I mean, that's ridiculous, right? You know, in a personal injury claim, that insurance company is, they're not involved in the medical care. Hopefully a lawyer is helping them a little bit. But even if it's just their primary care physician, they're going to get to competent doctors. They're not going to be going to doctors who rely on maybe a couple big insurance companies for all of their business, and they got to keep them happy, right? You're dealing with, you know, Jefferson or Penn or, you know, wherever.
So do you find that a lot of the time when the people are calling you, they're more hurt than the employer is making them out to be?
It can be. I can tell you, underdiagnosis at occupational medical clinics is an epidemic. I don't know how there are not more medical malpractice claims against them. I guess because they ultimately get to a lawyer, get to a doctor that's competent, and get operated on. I can tell you, if I ever had an on-the-job injury, I would never go to one of those clinics. I don't care if I have to pay for the medical treatment. It's just not worth it.
So I've heard around the dabblers that you've donated, and I love to use that word, that many of these people, not your firm, will only step in and help these individuals after they've had their claim denied. Is that something you do differently? Is there a particular reason that people would do that? And when I say the denied claim, is that basically the employer is saying, we're denying it, we're not paying anything, you're SOL.
Yeah, I think that I have heard that before. It's a mistake. Actually, the most valuable claims are ones that are not denied, just because the insured, when a workers' comp claim is going to settle, the way the claim is valued is, what is the risk to that insurance company? What benefits are they most likely going to be on the hook for? Or what can I sue them for and get that injured worker? On a denied claim, it's like you're starting from square one, right? You haven't had the trial yet. But on an accepted claim where someone is receiving wage loss benefits, and for the foreseeable future, unless something happens, they're going to receive those benefits, all of that risk is baked into that value. So it's a big mistake for the dabblers not to take anything other than denied claims, because they're the least valuable typically.
So in reviewing a lot of the documents that we've had with clients, a lot, many times our neurosurgeons or orthopedics will say that they're fully disabled. My understanding, at a very fundamental level, is that in the workers' comp world, they're percentages in a sense of they're 15% or 30%. Correct me if I'm wrong. I may be wrong.
So this varies from state to state. And you guys do what, Pennsylvania and Jersey?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's why. So in Jersey, they have impairment ratings. They're used a little bit differently than, and they also have permanent impairment and stuff. We don't do Jersey work. I've talked to some Jersey guys, so I have like a kindergartner's level of understanding on what they do over the bridge. I affectionately tell my wife, who is from New Jersey, it's like the armpit of America. So, you know, it is what
born and raised in Jersey.
Right.
It hurts a little. It hurts, well, a little. Like, you know, a little.
Look, I'm still friends with you, but I married a girl from Jersey. But so impairment ratings are used to cap benefits. So the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, in its infinite wisdom, does not think people should be on workers' comp forever. And so total disability in Pennsylvania is potentially payable for a lifetime. If you have a catastrophic injury, you can get comp for the rest of your life. However, after you've received 104 weeks total disability, meaning you're out of work, you've gotten 104 weeks worth of comp checks, they can send you to something called an impairment rating evaluation. If that impairment rating evaluator determines you have reached maximum medical improvement, meaning if the doctors do anything else, it's not going to make you better. You're not going to get any better. That impairment rating evaluator will give you an impairment rating. It's based on, I think it's the sixth edition of the guides. And if you have whole person impairment under 35%, your benefits will convert to partial disability. Now, that classification doesn't change the amount of the benefit, but it changes how much of it you can get. Because in Pennsylvania, partial disability benefits are capped at 500 weeks. Doesn't matter how injured you are, doesn't matter if you can't find another job, you will get a maximum of 500 weeks. of partial disability. Now, if you're over 35% whole body impairment, like I've handled a number of like catastrophic COVID claims where it's multiple body systems that have been affected, those impairment ratings are always well over 35%. Those people are going to be on comp for the rest of their lives. So it depends how serious the injury is, but that's how impairment ratings work here.
So I'm thinking of numbers now in my head, and the numbers kind of dawned on me. There's like, and the last time I checked statistically, there's over about 2 million people in Philadelphia now. That's a lot of workers and able bodies that are going. How are they, the employers and insurance side, the flip side, handling all of these claims? Because I'd like to say that people aren't getting hurt, but I would be moronic and oblivious to the fact to say that people aren't getting hurt every single day. Is there like a big box that kind of churns out these claims and defers them? Or because I can't imagine there's that many attorneys or there's that many entities that are just available to handle all these.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a boutique practice. The new numbers just came out from the Bureau, and I admittedly have not looked at them yet. But for 2023, there were about 35,000 petitions filed in the Workers' Comp Office of Adjudication, which is the government body that handles all of the disputes in the workers' comp system. And I don't know how many claims there were, but those are the ones where there were disagreements. So there's a significant number of claims, and there are a small pool of attorneys that handle it. But there are a number of insurers. There are a lot of insurance companies that write workers' comp. It's an incredibly profitable area of insurance for insurers.
Because I know on the PI side, basically the shelf life, like I told you, of a claim can be anywhere from 2 years to beyond that to 4 or 5 if you're in litigation. But when a case comes in, you have to set out that letter of rep, and you get assigned, depending who the insurance company is, Erie, Allstate, Progressive, Snake Farm, all those lovely people out there. Then a claims handler is ultimately assigned to that case. Is that the same thing that happens in the workers' comp world, so they can try to weed out some of these cases where there might not necessarily be a disagreement?
So yeah, there are adjusters assigned where you're going through a TPA that, you know, they've kind of outsourced the adjusting of the file. And they do weed out plenty of claims, and they deny a lot of claims they shouldn't deny. But the average cost of a workers' comp claim in Pennsylvania is under $2,000. So most claims are minor, and they're never picking up the phone and calling a lawyer. You know, you imagine the guy that bumped his knee on the corner of a table and went down to the occupational medicine place and got an ice pack, which they're great for that. Like you bump your knee and need an ice pack, go to occupational medicine. They have them. But those claims are fairly inexpensive, and an adjuster is just going to, you know, pay for that ice pack, and the guy goes back to work and never thinks about it ever again.
Do you have a favorite entity that you like working with on the workers' comp side?
No, I mean, there are definitely some that are better than others. I mean, I can think offhand, I like the insurers that use in-house counsel. I just did a video on this. But when you have in-house counsel, when I file that petition, that lawyer is going to pick up the phone, call me and say, what's going on with this? All right, let me call my adjuster. Let's figure out what the issue is. If that adjuster is doing something that's blatantly illegal, they're employed by the same company. It's not like some outside law firm that's trying to bill them by the hour is going to run out the file for 6 months. So Travelers uses in-house counsel. They're pleasant to deal with. Very good lawyers. Liberty Mutual is the same. Zurich, AmTrust. There are a number of...
We are not sponsored by any of those individuals. By
oh, that. No. They don't sponsor me either.
Tom is not sponsored by them either. Now I'm going to flip this on
I don't head. Think they like me either.
Who do you prefer not to work with?
The TPAs are awful. I just did a video about Sedgwick. Okay. And the way I described Sedgwick was banging your head against a brick wall over and over and over again. And then that basically sums up dealing with Sedgwick, Gallagher, Bassett.
And why is that, do you think?
It's a couple of things. One, they have no authority to do anything. So what a third-party administrator does is it takes away the decision-making of the day-to-day processing of the claim away from the people who actually cut the checks. Now, Sedgwick or Gallagher Bassett or whoever actually does write the check, but somebody else is footing the bill for it, some other insurance company or a self-insured. And so they don't have the authority to do anything, number one. And then number two, I think they're overworked and underpaid. I don't want to get sued for defamation. I don't know it for sure, But what I can tell you is I find I have a lot of inexperienced adjusters that are working in too many states with too many files and have no idea what's going on. And they're doing something blatantly illegal in Pennsylvania. Like, I mean, it might be legal in Texas or wherever else they're handling claims, but it's not legal here. And I'll say to them, you can't do this. And they have no clue. And then I have to file a lawsuit and then wait for their lawyer to, you know, bill the insurance company for 6 months to tell them it's illegal.
I did enjoy that video. I knew that that was going to strike a chord with you. So I told you before we came on that I was going to ask you about that. And I just had to find a place that I wanted to jab it in. And if anybody could see under the table right now, Tom's feet and everything.
No, I'm excited. I'm like dancing.
Oh my, what a time to be alive. So we talked a little bit about just the processes and the fears and ultimately what a potential client or a client will go through. Now, what are some common misconceptions that you hear from clients when they come to you for a workplace injury?
They think I can fix it immediately. And they want to know, well, wait, why am I not receiving checks? Isn't workers' comp just you pick up the phone and call them and turn my checks on? I'm like, well, if they accepted liability for the claim, otherwise they have this thing called due process. We have to sue them and then prove that you're entitled to these benefits. And that process can take a while. So I think the timeline is the biggest misconception. And the second one we've touched on a little bit is there is no pain and suffering in workers' comp. A lot of people think that there is. And so some people are very shocked to find out that I'm going to get them their wages, I'm going to get them their medical, but then that's it.
Now, does that include past, present, and future medicals, or is that only limited to just a certain?
So workers' comp will pay past and present. It does not pay future, unless you are settling. So when we talk about lump sums, a lump sum in Pennsylvania is a settlement. You're signing something called a compromise and release agreement, and you're compromising either all or part of your claim, and the insurance company is essentially buying out the future risk on that claim. So that would cover your future wage loss, at least from that perspective.
So you've been at this, I think we were talking, in almost a decade. What has kind of changed in the workers' comp landscape? Any big shifts in the system or how cases are being kind of handled?
There are two big shifts. So we've had two large waves of retirements of workers' comp judges. So we had a number of judges who had been in this system for decades deciding cases. And that is kind of changing. It started with COVID because our system, which is going to be the second thing I'll talk about, has changed significantly since COVID. And then even more recently in the past year or so, we've had a number of judge retirements. And so we're seeing some of the sort of new guard come in. People I went to law school with are becoming workers' comp judges now. Whereas when I started practicing 10 years ago, you know, it was a guy who was 70 years old up on the bench who'd been on the bench before I was born.
Is that election or is that appointment?
They're all appointed.
Oh, okay.
And I don't think they have to take a test anymore, but there are requirements in order to be a workers' comp judge. You have to have practiced substantially out of 5 out of the last 7 years in workers' comp. And so most of the workers' comp judges were either claimants' attorneys, defense attorneys, or both at some point in their career. The other big change is we don't have that much in-person court anymore. So it's gone. It used to be we would be driving, you know, I'd start in the morning and drive up to Hazleton and then drive to Harrisburg and then do a hearing in the afternoon or a deposition in the afternoon in Philadelphia. And now we're averaging about 3 to 4 in-person hearings a week, but we have dozens of cases every week that are going to court. Most of them are virtual.
Zoom is a beautiful thing. I would say that is the greatest thing that's ever happened. The ability to touch more people and to basically jump across the aisle, jump across state lines, sometimes county lines, all that stuff is just a great thing to have.
I think it's also made the system a lot more efficient. I mean, if you're thinking about an insurance company that's now, you know, going to have to pay their lawyer to drive from their office to a courtroom, drive back because they pay for the drive time. And then you have all the gas that they're burning. I mean, it is so much more efficient. And there are some lawyers that moan and groan and complain that they can't book insurance companies for driving for dollars, they used to call it. But it has made the system much more efficient. It's saving the Commonwealth a ton of money. And I find that it's much easier to get hearings. So you have a problem in a case and you file a penalty petition, say, hey, this insurance company's breaking the rules. There are some judges, I'm going to have a hearing in 2 weeks. And it's because we've cut out a lot of that nonsense.
So you talked a lot about different things. You said the penalty hearing and all that stuff. I wish we had hours to talk about this. So if there's anything in particular listeners or followers want to hear more about, you can always go to Tom's TikTok, and I'll let him give that hashtag on the hand tip, the handle, I guess they call it nowadays. And he's always jumping on live, answering questions, very interactive. I get some humor out of some of the things he does. And it's very, when I tell you, Philly is instilled in his blood, it truly is. And it goes to the testament of the work and the results that he does. Final thought. What's one piece of advice, if you had someone injured on the job today, that could make a huge difference in their outcome in their case?
The very first thing you should do after you have reported your injury and gotten checked out by a doctor is pick up the phone and call the workers' comp lawyer. It costs you absolutely nothing. You don't even have to hire them, but get a consult, get an idea from an expert on what it is you should be doing, because the insurance company has an expert. They have an adjuster. They have a lawyer. Shouldn't you?
And what's the TikTok if people want to follow along and ask you about Sedgwick and all Gallagher Bassett?
Sedgwick is going to sue me at some point. At THWESQ is my handle. And somebody was requesting a video on Gallagher Bassett. I saw it in the comments. I'm
like, it might have been me.
But I appreciate you having me. This has been a ton of fun.
This has been awesome. So everyone, thanks again from the Injury Pros for joining us here. A big shout out to Tom Wake for bringing us the heat and the wisdom on workers' comp. Whether you're a Philly area worker or just someone looking for straight answers, we've got your back. If you're hurt on the job, Tom's got your back. Catch more episodes at injurypros.com. Follow along on your podcast app of choice and watch the show, full show. See us in our t-shirt and suits and everything else on YouTube. Till next time, stay safe.